Maria was following the same plan as Esther, which means before Esther could work on the external situation, she had to first perfect herself, to be aware of all of her own emotions, and that she had to be in line with the objective reality. See, that's the way the tzaddik responds to a crisis is before, first he deals with himself. The first step is not to just react impulsively. And you see people that reacted impulsively, for example, Reuven, that's Pachas Kamayim, that's the criticism of Reuven. Reuven wanted to save his brother, he wanted to save Yosef, but he always acted impulsively, and he affected his actions. The thing is like this though, there's a time for action, and there's a time for reflection. When you're faced with the possibility of an imminent danger, you gotta prepare for your defense, that you don't start praying. When the enemy is coming against you, when you have to set up a defense, you just set up a defense. So the first thing you did was, vayachad, that he had to do immediately. That did not require any tefillah, that didn't require any introspection. Then, when he had to work out a plan of how to appease his brother, which entailed not just abstract reasoning, but it also entailed being aware of all of his own emotions, where the way he acted, the way he set it up, and the emotions that were operating within him would affect the plan, then first he has to respond. Tefillah is where the person first perfects himself. He's aware of his own emotions. He has to be aware of his own fear, his own emotion. He has to be in line with God's plan. He has to be in line with reality. Once he's removed all of these factors which can impede his own method of operating, then he goes into the plan. Because this was, as I said, if it's just a bribe, it's just paying off money, you don't need any big chachmah. But you see, everything was done with tremendous chachmah. And also tremendous awareness of his own emotions, the way he carried it off. It was done in a fit. And to the seven bowings and so forth, to be able to pull that off and to remove all those feelings that he might have of superiority and to show that type of a picture to Esav required tremendous chachmah. So that's why tefillah precedes the dorah. But the first thing you have to do is prepare for war in case of a surprise attack. So that's the he says, this is in Lamed Gimel, Pasuk Yud. And Yaakov said, Alma, please know, in Nama Tati Chen Bienech, if I found favor in your eyes, V'lakasim Yichosi B'yadi, listen to this. You shall take the gift from my hand, Yalken your Isi Panech, because seeing your face is Kiros Pnei Elohim V'akirteni. It's like seeing the face of an exalted individual. And it's a sign. Yeah, that's what he's saying. It's a sign that you found favor. I'm looking for your favor, the fact that you'll accept the skip. So you see that's that's what he's trying to do here. Okay? But it would be helpful to follow in the text, because I want to do a lot of textual analysis of the story. Because the way it's working, it's in chapter 34, the story of Dina. Let's just read through the story first, and then we'll set up the questions, and then we'll try and work out the answers. And I don't know if I'll be able to a lot of material on this. I don't know if I'll be able to do it all in 1 week. Perhaps we'll make a two-part session out of it. We'll see how it goes. So it says that Dina, the daughter of Leah. All right, so now you know that Yaakov did have a daughter. He did have, in addition to the 12 sons, he had a daughter, Dina. Went out. Asher yeldo Yaakov, who had been born to Yaakov. Liros of no sorrows. What does that mean? To be seen, I guess, to hang out, so to speak. The Chazal criticized her on this. She sort of like, in a certain sense, went where she shouldn't have. She should have rather been more careful. Not that she did anything overtly wrong, but that she sort of like went out. What is it called when you have a debutante, that kind of thing? She sort of went out, and as a result, she got into trouble. And Shechem, the son of Hamor, from the Chivi, who was the prince of the land, that is Hamor, saw her, and he took her, and he forced her. He forcibly, in other words, he raped her, to put matters bluntly. The term is vayishtavosa, vayaneha. That means inui, humiliating her. Well, that's humiliation. Now, what's the vayaneha? Ramban says he disagrees with Rashi. Rashi wants to say vayishtav refers to having sex in one way, and Vayaneh, the humiliation is that he had sex with her in an unnatural way, so that he humiliated her in that way. But the Ramban takes issue with that, and he disagrees, and he says that all forced sexual relations, when a woman is forced, that itself is humiliation. That's a humiliation. So he says the reason why the pasuk mentions vayaneha, because if it simply would have said vayishkavo, so that he had relations with her, then it would imply that she was at fault, that she might have wanted it too. But it says that he humiliated her to mention her virtue, that she was virtuous, and that this was a humiliation, that she was forced, that she didn't want this relationship at all, even though he was a very important person, you know, the son of the leader and so forth. Okay. So she was taken by force. Minister Strain then says that his soul clung to Dina, the daughter of Yaakov, and he loved the young girl, and he spoke to her heart. That's a very strange kind of phenomenon. He starts off by raising her, and then he falls in love with her, and he's trying to win her over. Something happened over here. It's something I think we should try and account for. I mean, because if a person, that's not the way a person behaves. And you see that from that point on, he didn't force her. Now he tries to win her over, right, to get her to court. He has her in his control. He can do whatever he wants, but now he's trying to win her over, win her heart. So something happened over here. But we'll come back to that later. I'm just going to note the questions as we go along. So what does he do? Apparently, she could not be won over. She refuses. So Shem goes to his father. His father was the ruler. And he spoke to his father and said, acquire from me this young girl for a wife. And Yaakov heard that they had defiled his daughter Dina. And his sons were with their animals in the field. In other words, when he received the information that his daughter had been raped by Shechem, and at this time the sons were out in the field with the animals. And Yaakov kept quiet until they came in. Okay, what does it mean? Yeah, what does it mean? That he kept quiet, yes? Oh, he didn't go to Shechem himself? Oh, I took it that way, yeah. I took it that way, that he, instead of acting immediately and running out to tell them what had happened, he waited for them to come into the field. And the Torah sees fit to point this out. Well, first of all, why did he wait? And the Torah sees fit to tell us this, that there must be some point over here. I don't think it means that he desisted from taking action against Shechem or against Hamor, because I think he realized that for that he needed the family to work together, he needed the sons. But rather than go out and tell them, he waited, he kept quiet. He kept quiet until they came in. So, what's the reason for that? Do you want to answer right away, or do you want to put it on the question list? It's like Lori, that again it shows you the perfection of the tzaddik. I would agree. I think this also shows us many examples of this. The manner in which the tzaddik operates in a situation of danger. In other words, that he does not act in the heat of the moment, under the sway of the powerful emotion. The first thing he does is he maintains control over himself. So Yaakov realized that this would have a very strong emotional effect upon the sons, and he didn't want to make it worse. In other words, the fact of the matter is, it's bad enough, as we see. When they heard, they were extremely distressed. They didn't like this. Had Yaakov gone out to the field to meet them, I think it would have created a different type of an emotion, and it would have been more difficult to formulate a rational plan. That's where I view it. So sometimes, you know, there's a time for action, and sometimes greatness consists in the ability to be quiet, to hold back something which you want to tell. And I think that we can all relate to that, because it's not just in this situation, but very often that's a big challenge. Like a person the desire to tell certain types of information is very, very powerful. All right? Of course, Lashon Hara, but not only Lashon Hara. Sometimes it's not Lashon Hara, and it's something very nice and pleasant, and you have a tremendous desire to tell. Right? That can be a very painful thing, just to keep quiet sometimes and not say something. What? Right. That's a tremendous thing, right. But, but there you have an issue. You have an outright issue. But to maintain control over yourself and not to tell, not to give out certain information, is a perfection. Then it says the children of Yaakov came from the field when they heard. So they heard too. And as soon as they heard, they came in. And the men were distressed. They were upset. Oxford is depression. And they were exceedingly angry because a nevala, an abomination, had been done in Israel to sexually take the daughter of Yaakov, the Chen Boyeyosa. And that's another machlokas. Rashi interprets it to mean that this was not done. He means this was viewed, this would be an abomination even for the standards of the nations. Because he says that the nations had accepted upon themselves the geder of the Arayah. So this was something that shouldn't be done. Ramban disagrees with him. Ramban says that's not the case, because later on in Vayikra, when God rebukes the Jews about these sexual abominations, and God, Kichol HaTo'ad Osa'ela, because all of these abominations, the nations that occupy, the seven nations, were guilty of all these abominations, and that's why God is destroying them. So the Ramban says, how can you say that they were, they restrained themselves from Arayos, from forbidden sexual activity? So he says, no, V'chein lo yeyosa means, for Yaakov, for the Jews, for the Bnei Yaakov, this type of thing was simply intolerable. Okay, that's the end of this phase. Now the next phase. Now Hamor comes. So Hamor comes because Shechem had asked his father to acquire the young girl. And Hamor spoke to them saying, Shechem Bini, my son Shechem, his soul desires your daughter. Chashka Nafsha, it's very powerful. He's fallen in love. He's fallen in love with your daughter. Please give her to him for a wife. Okay, that's his first. Now you would think that basically everything that follows should pertain just to that, just to obtaining, that was the mission. The mission was to obtain Dina for a wife, to get their consent. I would guess that, see, Dina was in a difficult situation over here. What did Dina say to Shechem? It doesn't tell us. It says merely that Shechem spoke to her. His first objective was to speak to her. Now what did she say? She was in a tough situation. She was caught. The Torah doesn't tell us what she said, but we can deduce what she said, apparently. Well, I would say that, I don't know if she said that, because why would he then go to his father? What caused Shechem to go to his father and say, if he couldn't win her over, why did he think his father could win her over? Now my guess is that she didn't want to just say outright that I don't want to reject him, because that would make the situation get him angry, and then he could just be crazy and not let her go and keep her forcefully. So I imagine that she might have said something that the way they conduct themselves is that you have to get permission from my father. That she did not, and as I'm saying, that she did not take that position, she just rejected him. She, in order to put herself on it, that way she has some safety. She's not rejecting him, and then he has to go to the father. And she had enough confidence that Yaakov, once he went to Yaakov, then Yaakov would work out a way. In other words, she trusted her father to handle the situation properly, either to save her or some way could be worked out. And that's why, even though the Torah doesn't tell us this, but that explains why Hamor now comes to Yaakov. Now, but he says like this, and you will intermarry. We'll marry, amongst each other. We will give our daughters, your daughters you will give to us, and Our daughters, you will take for yourself. Okay? And you will dwell with us, and the land will be before you. Dwell in it, and uscharua. What does it mean, uscharua? And do business. And they also burn, seize it. In other words, establish yourselves, maintain yourselves over here. So, of course, this seems to be unrelated to the whole thing. What does that have to do with it? In other words, all he asked for is, Shem didn't ask for any of this. All Shem is interested in is Dina. So he mentions Dina, but then he has a whole different agenda. So why did he bring this in? Yeah, okay. Yeah, but let's see what that agenda was. Now Shem speaks up. Then Shem said to her father and her brothers, now Shem speaks up, the culprit, the rapist. Alright? I heard, in other words, in hopes to find favor, may I find favor in your eyes, and whatever you tell me to do, I will give. Increase greatly the dowry, the gift, and I'll give it. In other words, like now he's proposing whatever amount he names as a dowry. In other words, he wants to be respectful and to give her a worthy dowry. And I will give whatever you say to me. And please give me the young girl for a wife. Now, that's the end of the mission. That's the end of the speech. But it's interesting that now Shem speaks up. The question arises, Shem apparently had entrusted the mission to his father, and the father does make the request. Right? First he makes the request for my son, Dina, right? Then he mentions the other proposal, which is a totally different proposal, and now Shem again comes up with their, what was their plan? Why did they both make the request for Dina? In other words, the speech of Hamor should have ended, and that should, then they should have waited for a response. Why, after he makes the request, does Shem now come in and make his personal request? Okay? Alright, that's another question. We'll come back to it. Now it says, now the answer of Bnei Yaakov. The Bnei Yaakov answered Shem and his father Hamor, b'mirma. What is mirma? Rashi says, well, mirma is cunning, b'chachma. They answered them with cunning and with wisdom, b'chachma. They answered them with tremendous. So what we're going to try and do is find out what the chachma was. Okay. Well, actually, Vayidaberu, and they spoke. As far as your question is concerned, the Ramban speaks about it. The Ramban mentions that it wasn't, in other words, that Yaakov, all this took place in the presence of Yaakov was there, but because it wasn't dignified. The Yaakov being the great sage and the father, then to have to do the actual negotiating. Like, he was in the background, and they confer with him, and they would do the actual talking and negotiating out of cover. In other words, the dignity. Even though Hamor himself, who was the Nasi, spoke, but Yaakov, they didn't allow to speak. They did the speaking. Alright? That's what the Ramban says. It makes sense. And they spoke, Ashatimei as Dina Chosam, regarding the fact that they had defiled their daughter, Dina. And why does the Pasuk mention that in Ashatimei? Yes? Why does it mention at this point? Right. In other words, again, I believe it's an Ramban. Right? Oh, no, it's Rashi. Take a look at Rashi. Ashatimei. Hakatav Omer, the Pasuk tells us, Shlohai Saramiya, that this was not deception or trickery. In other words, it wasn't immoral. It wasn't unethical kind of trickery. It was justified. Why? Sharaitime asdina. That they had a right to do what they did. They tricked them, as we're going to read, they tricked them. But it wasn't deceit because Ashatime, they had defiled Dina. And they said to them, now let's look for the Chachma. Where is the Chachma over here? They said, we cannot do this thing to give our daughter to a man who is uncircumcised. For that is a rebuke to us. That is An embarrassment, that's despised. That's something which is despised. We would regard that as being despising. But only with this will it be acceptable to us. If you shall be like us, to circumcise for yourselves every male. And we will give our daughters to you, and your daughters we will take to us, and we will live with you, and we will be one nation. We'll be one nation. Now, pay attention to those words. Because they seem to be, they're responding to the proposal, but they're not saying exactly. He didn't make any proposal, I don't recall, mentioning anything about one nation over here. They're throwing in, they're going, they're upping the ante. I don't remember in his speech, you could check it out, where he made that kind of a proposal of becoming one nation. But also bear in mind that in both cases, in the proposal of Hamor and in their answer, who would have the upper hand over here in terms of the marriage situation? In terms of the marriage situation, who would have the upper hand? Well, now it's very clear that you, in other words, you will give us your daughters, meaning that who you'll have the upper hand. You will take our daughters, so you'll have the pick. In other words, we will have the weaker position, because you will have the choice of any daughters you want, basically. You'll have rights to our daughters. And as far as us marrying your daughters, that'll be only the ones that you decide to give to us. So clearly, the proposal of Hamor and the way they expressed it over here was that the Bnei Yaakov would have the upper hand. Right? Then he says like this, but if you do not listen to us to circumcise, then we will take our daughter and we will leave. So that's pretty strong. We will take our daughter and we will leave. So that's the proposal, and what we have to analyze is wherein, in this proposal, lies the nirma. Where is the chachma over here? This was, supposedly, this idea is tremendous chachma. Now, we're going to come back to it. I'm just setting out the problem. Do you want to continue the story, though? Let's get the whole picture. Yeah. I mean, Laurie's right. Their objective was to save Dina. Their objective was to save Dina, but they made it all contingent upon accepting this proposal. If you accept this proposal, it's all or nothing. We can't go back to the way things were. No, not at all. They hid, part of obviously another aspect of their wisdom and their discipline was that they totally hid their anger. They were extremely angry, and we'll see soon, how they expressed their anger. That will come out very quickly. But in the negotiations, it was not apparent at all. Both Hamor and Shem were there. And in order for this to succeed, it was imperative that no, they shouldn't, because it's one thing not to overtly display, but people can pick up a certain coldness. And certainly, Shem would have been looking very, very carefully for that, to see whether these guys are upset with him. I'm surprised it even went along. He went along. Now, the matter was very good in the eyes of Hamor and in the eyes of Shem ben Hamor. Now, what does it tell you? Why does the pasuk have to mention both? And in other words, each one, they were both there on the set, but each one had his own agenda. That shows clearly that they were working together, but father and son had two separate agendas. And the matter was very good. Now, he didn't delay. The lad did not hesitate. Why? Because he was very desirous of the daughter of Yaakov. And he was more respected, and he was the most respected in the entire house of his father. So, I mean, you see that he had very powerful emotions. You don't put things off. A person doesn't put things off when he has very strong emotions, and he was madly in love, and he couldn't wait to get married to her. So he wants to get this thing into action right away. Now, what's Hamor's task? What's Hamor's task? Now, go and convince the entire, that's one thing for him. He was very satisfied. Now, as far as Shem is concerned, okay, to be willing to undergo circumcision, that's the whole idea of it. That's something which is a tremendous amount of resistance. It's very unpleasant. It's very painful, especially for grown men. Right? To accept that condition is not an easy thing. So now Hamor, you'll see he was a very intelligent guy. Now we'll see the intelligence of Hamor. How is he going to convince the entire people, his entire group, his entire nation, to accept this, these conditions. So let's take up his proposal. So Hamor and Shechem, his son, came to the gate, and they gathered all the men, and they said, now let's, the next few verses we'll see his intelligence, how he convinces them. These men are at peace with us. Shleimim, they're peaceful, they're honest, they're trustworthy people, and they're at peace with us. And they will dwell in the land and do business. Let them do business. And the land is very big in front of them. There's a lot of space, very spacious. And Rashi says, take a look at Rashi. Rashi says that the land, there's a tremendous amount of space over here, which means to say you won't lose anything. You won't lose any business. A lot of stuff comes by over here. A lot of people come and there's no one to buy. So you won't lose out on any business. We need more people. There's not enough people. There's not enough business going on. You won't lose anything. Then he says that their daughters we will take for wives, and our daughters we will give to them. Very interesting. Yeah, suddenly that's not the way it was. Not the way I read the story. It was in the reverse. You see, when he presents it to them, he presents it differently. He presents it that we have the upper hand. Right? Everything is great. It's a fantastic clinic you got over here. However, just achpazot, there's one little, things, whenever things are so, good, right, there's always a little hitch. So there's just a slight little hitch. No big deal. No big problem. Just with this, will it be acceptable? Will it be acceptable for these people to dwell with us? To become one nation? See, Liyos La'amechad. He took up their proposal. That in that we circumcise for ourselves every male, just like they are circumcised. Just like they are circumcised. And now take a look at 23. I don't know where this comes from, but right, he had some kind of poetic license over here, Hamor. Their flocks, their animals, their possessions, everything they own, hello, Lanuhan, will be ours. But we must be acceptable to them. That's a reference to the Milah. Achmed, he repeats. He repeats the condition of Milah in two sentences. In 22, he presents it to them outright, and then he comes back to it in 23 in an indirect way. Now, what did he mean? The Yesh we tunnel, and let them dwell with us. That's the end of his speech. That's the proposal, because he couldn't, accept this without their consent. They have to accept it, we want to accept it. This is the way he proposed it. And you can see that he himself made some changes over here too. And they listened to Hamor and Shechem, his son, everyone that went through the gates, everybody in the city, and they circumcised every male, everybody who was an inhabitant of that city. Okay, so they followed the plan. Right? Now, what happens next? Now comes the unexpected. It was on the third day, as we know, the third day is the most painful day, right? The Yosef and Kalam, when they were in the greatest pain. The two sons of Yaakov, Shimon and Levi, the brothers of Dina, they were brothers of Dina. Of course, all the sons were, but they were from Leah, right? Full brothers. Each one took his sword, and they came upon the city quietly. They snuck in, and they killed out every male. And Hamor and his son Shechem, they killed by the sword. They didn't spare anyone. Not even like, even Shaul spared Agag. They didn't kill Agag. They didn't spare the leaders, anyone. And they took Dina from the house of Shechem, and they left. Then, it says, the sons of Yaakov, and apparently, is this Shimon and Levi, or is this all the sons? The sons of Yaakov came upon the corpses, and they despoiled, they took all the spoils, all the wealth, they cleaned out the place. Asher Tilu Achosam, that had defiled their sister. I would believe so. I mean, you don't have to learn that way, but I would imagine so. Or you could say it's just Shimon and Levi, or you could say it's all the brothers. Alright? I'm sure there's different interpretations. When Yosef took the hostage from one of the brothers, who did he pick? He picked Shimon. Why did he pick Shimon? because he wanted to separate him from Levi. He didn't want... In other words, if he'd have picked another brother, and he knew what they had done, then they have Shimon and Levi. They're very tough guys. He didn't want to have to be contend with that. Yeah, he split them up. That's what... It says by Yavo, he took the Ha'echad, the one. Rashi points out that Shimon was the one that he picked, that he separated, that he picked out as the hostage. You didn't know this. Play, what happens next? Okay, so then it says all of their wealth and all of their children, all of their wives, they returned and they took as spoils. So they wiped out the place. I mean, they didn't kill the women and children. No, it said they took them and everything that was in the houses. So they killed all the men and they took away everything. They carted everything off. They took all the wealth. You don't mess around with Shimon and Levi. Shovel by Yavoza, right? They captured them. Right? No, they took them. I'm sorry. They didn't kill them, but they took them. They took them to themselves as slaves, not to marry. And now, what's the conclusion of the story? Now Yaakov enters the picture. Yaakov said to Shimon and to Levi, "Achartem osi, you have made me an object of hatred. Achor means dirty. You've made me into something which is dirty and despised. L'havisheni b'yoshev v'aret, to cause me to be despised by the inhabitants of the land, the Canaanite and the Perizzi." In other words, you've created a tremendous, you've endangered me. I'm in a tremendous state of day. They're all going to have tremendous anger and hatred against me now. And Anochi Misei Mispa. I'm very small. I'm a small group. I can't fight off all these different armies over here. They'll all gather upon me, and they will smite me, and I will be destroyed, me and my house. So Yaakov chastises them, and he gives them a tremendous rebuke. This is how can you do a crazy thing like this? Horrible thing. And they said, "Hakazona Yaakov Zachosena? Shall they make our sister into a harlot?" And that's the end of the discussion. So we don't hear. It seems to be like a stalemate. They were tough guys. They didn't just sneakily say, "Okay, you're right. I'm sorry," but they answered. They said, "No, you did the right thing. We cannot tolerate that our sister should be treated like a harlot." So it's not clear. It seems to be a machlokas over here. But there's many, many problems. Some of the problems we've mentioned, but now we'll cite some of the remaining questions. And we'll try and answer some of them, and for next week we'll complete it. That is the major question, and the great commentators address themselves to this question. One of your assignments for next week will be to do a major Ramban on Yud Gimel. It's almost two columns of Ramban. Okay? 13. Ramban 13. He raises the question, and he says that the story doesn't make any sense because obviously it would seem that what they did was the mirma. That was a deception. It would seem that way, that they never... I mean, were they serious in their proposal? Did they make the proposal in good faith? Was it a good faith proposal? That if you will follow our conditions, then we will become one nation, we'll dwell with you, we'll... All right, as far as the arrangements with the... who marries, who gets to pick who, there seemed a little difference of opinion, but whatever. If it was a good faith arrangement, so then how could they... It doesn't make sense. So what did Shimon and Levi go ahead and do? Or else it was some kind of a trick. If it was a trick, if this was the whole plan that they never intended, and Rashi seems to indicate that the whole thing was the mirma, and they had Asher Timei, that they had a right to falsify, they had a right to be deceptive, because, well, by the way, I mean, you see, from this, I mean, I think everybody will agree with this. You know, when the United States, when they're taking hostages, and Iran, and... All right, so they... I'm not going to argue what the right policy was, you know, whether we should have mounted an attack or not. But nevertheless, in the end, they were able to get them out, but they had frozen the Iranian assets, if you remember. And part of the agreement was that when they returned the hostages, we would unfreeze the assets. All right? So then I remember Carter was arguing, and Reagan actually, I think, filed this. I held that once we... I don't know what your position was, but my position was that the deal was structured that we would not unfreeze until they were returned. Now, once they were returned, who's going to force us to... We had complete control, right? So, what would you say? Are you mechuyev to... Let's say the same situation occurred. Somebody kidnapped somebody, and we had some of his money, so we held on, we freezed his money. And then the deal was, you'd give him back, and you... Would you unfreeze? No, I would not. I would say we're not bound, because that's not an agreement. That's not a contract. A contractual agreement is one which is carried out, right, with both parties are operating under free will. It's a voluntary agreement, and you have to honor your agreement. But this was simply a matter of coercion. If somebody comes and steals from you, he has the right to do that. They're stealing. Now, I can make any promise I want in order to save a life. I'm not bound by that promise. You see? In other words, if I promise a murderer or a kidnapper that if he releases, I'll give him a few million dollars. And let's say he trusts me, whatever the case may be. Because usually they won't do it. They know you. And let's say he keeps... Am I bound? Is that... Of course not. Of course not. Because in that situation, I'm permitted to do anything to save a life. So, you see that in this situation, they were permitted to use Mirma in order to save the life of Dina. And Carter was arguing that the United States has to honor its word. That people won't trust us anymore. But I said, that's totally absurd. Because people will recognize that that's not the framework in which you give your word. The framework in which you honor your word is a situation in which it's done with voluntarily, and it's a just situation, and you've made an agreement. Now, the situation has changed. Whatever, you still have to keep your word. But that is not an agreement. That is something which you've done only out of coercion. So there's no obligation. The question is, it would seem that they were operating with a certain plan. Right? If that's the case, then they conferred with Yaakov. Then Yaakov must have known the plan. If Yaakov knew the plan, so why is he rebuking them afterwards? And if not, so then what was his understanding of the situation? Then they were operating with two different plans. Then the family, then Shimon and Levi clearly had one plan, and Yaakov must have had another plan. So then we have to clarify what exactly was the plan of each. Moreover, there's a fundamental question over here, which must be raised. Aside from that, let's forget about that. Let's assume there were two different plans, and Yaakov did not intend to wipe them out. He had a different idea. And they were faking out Yaakov as well. It could be that Shimon and Levi weren't just faking out Tamar, maybe they were faking out Yaakov as well. But there's one more very, very fundamental question, which the Ramban talks about, and the Rambam talks about. What's that? Okay, that's a good question, but that's. But the point is, that only assumes that he really intended to follow through. If he didn't intend to follow through, then there's no problem. Another fundamental question is, you see that the rebuke of Yaakov was based upon what? His anger. Practical consideration. He doesn't write. He didn't say that he did anything morally wrong. He just right. Apparently he held that it, from the moral point of view, what they did was all right. But that it was a dangerous thing to do. In terms of, you endangered us. We're not big enough to do this kind of thing. And that's why it was bad. And the brothers argued back that no, we have no choice. We have to do this. Right? But the question is, what was the moral justification for what they did? How could they? In other words, if you're going to tell me that they have a right, as far as Shem is concerned, Shem was the perpetrator of the crime. He was guilty. And what would his just punishment be for taking Dina and for raping her, for kidnapping her? I mean, it was Gezel. It was not just an act of, it was an act of rape, it was an act of stealing, it was kidnapping, because he was holding her against a hostage, against her will. It wasn't as though if he would have been halfway decent, he could have returned Dina and then come back like a mensch and say, I want to repent, I ask your forgiveness, which he never said, and now I've changed and I'd like to marry her. But he didn't do that. She was still there. So this also, bear in mind, just that the sons of Yaakov, this wasn't spoken, and this, you might think this is what the sons of Yaakov or Yaakov did, the first thing. The first thing I would have, see, I'm not the Yaakov, the first thing I would have said would be, okay, fine, we're ready to talk. I mean, this has been a terribly distressing thing, but if you're really sincere and we're talking good faith, well, first give us back Dina. Once we have Dina back, then we'll, that's not even mentioned. Yaakov, they don't propose it, and Yaakov doesn't ask for it. Interesting. I hope so. But, well, I have an answer, whether it's the answer, you know. One second. The question is, so what does he deserve in terms of punishment? He deserves to be killed. He's chayav mitzvah. He's guilty of the death, but definitely because he's a Noachide. He's an Noachide. And, well, even a Jew is killed for kidnapping, but kidnapping has certain you know how to kidnap another Jew. Kidnapping has certain technicalities before you can actually get the death penalty. But for a Noachide, he's guilty, first of all, of arayos, right? And for gezel, he's a violation of two. Of two of these seven Noachide laws, and a ben Noach is chayav mitzvah. A ben Noach is chayav mitzvah for any one of the seven. Then he only has seven laws to keep, but the penalty for not keeping them is mitzvah. But what about the innocents? The rest of the people, I don't want you to answer the question now. Okay. But the subject of answering this question is a machlokas. There's an argument between the Ramban and the Rambam. And I basically will probably leave this to next week. I'm going to try and answer some of the other questions. The question is, what was the moral justification for wiping out the whole town, all the men, for killing them? They didn't sin. They were innocent. They had nothing to do with this. There's no indication whatsoever that the people of the city were guilty. And if that's the case, what was the justification? And Yaakov, in condemning them, doesn't even mention that. He doesn't condemn them for doing an avera, for killing innocent people. He only condemns them for doing something which is dangerous, for endangering me. What about the moral issue? All right. I'm sorry, Malki had a question. Malki's making a good point that perhaps the specific identification of the sin would not be arayos because she was single. She wasn't a married woman. But then it would be rape. And rape would be a form of gezel, of stealing. So, it's a good point. It's a good point. I'd like to see if we can answer some of the questions. Okay, Lori? Yeah, it's true. But in our context, the bigger question, the biggest sin, unless they're justified. If it's not justified, the biggest sin will be the killing. If you kill and then plunder, you go in and you slay, you destroy a whole city of people, thousands of people, and then you take all the wealth. So, of course, both are wrong, but of the two, the killing is much worse. The people would have been glad to give their, you know, their wealth.
But society could have understood the killing. They might not have understood.
You've got a good point. You've got a good point. What are you suggesting? Well, I just would like to hold off on that. Oh, I don't want to discuss it right now. Just please make a note of it. Laurie's making a good point, because what Laurie is saying is that in the eyes of society, the fact that they plundered changes the whole character of how the act of killing will be perceived.
Right.
That perhaps if they had desisted from the plunder, if they had just restricted themselves to killing, whatever the justification, then it would have a whole different slant, a whole different appearance in the eyes of the people. I would go back to our first question. We said it was strange that first he takes her by force, first he humiliates her, he rapes her, and then the next thing we know, he's pleading with her. He's a gentleman. He's suddenly become a gentleman, and he's willing to get the most beautiful gift. He's going to lavish jewelry and whatever they say. I mean, obviously, so, you know, whatever she wants. What happened over here? Laurie is suggesting that we contrast the reaction of Shem to that of Amnon and Tamar. But I don't want to go into it right now, because you have to know the story of Amnon and Tamar, and maybe at the end we'll come back to it. I like that idea very much. Because he behaves in a terrible, terrible way. He raped Tamar, who was halachically wasn't his sister, but technically was, you know, biologically was, he was not halachically. And he could have married her, right. But he had this mad attraction for her and schemed to get her alone, and he raped her. And then after raping her, he was thoroughly disgusted with her, and he said, get rid of her, and he threw her out, and humiliated her. And he, a person who's on a high level, he was the son of the king, acts in a way which was much different, seems to be, I'm sorry? No. That's Amnon, that's a different Tamar, not the same Tamar. Okay, and here we have this Shem, who was an Arel, seemingly on a low level, and he rapes the girl, does the same crime basically, and yet his reaction is entirely different. And why would that be? So Lurie has an interesting suggestion. I want to think it through some more. Now, I think he came up with something. But plainly, I mean, I'm not going into any psychology over here. It started out as a sexual attraction. She was obviously a beautiful girl, and he was just sexually attracted to her, so he took her. He was a behemoth, which shows he was basically an animal. But then he got to know her. He got to see her, and she had qualities that were very attractive to him. And it's interesting that, because I'll say that the most attractive, see, people think that if you adopt the path of modesty, it sort of impedes you. It makes it more difficult for you to be attractive. I know, for example, like women sometimes ask, I mean, some woman asks, usually once, because the halach is that when you get married, you have to cover your hair. So the halach is that if you get divorced, so then you, once you cover your hair, you still cover, a divorced woman still covers her hair. That's the halach. And R.I. Chait gave a share last year, and he explained, yeah, even if you're widowed. Yeah, because once you make that change, he explained the whole concept behind it. That it's really an advance in terms of a person's a maturity level. It shows a new level of maturity. So once you attain that level in marriage, then you don't go back. You retain it. And you stay with it even after you're not married, you're divorced or whatever. But sometimes women say that they have a problem, that they're dating, they want to get married, and it's going to impede. I'm not going into a whole lot of discussion right now. I'll get sidetracked. And there are certain cases where it's a terror. Yeah, because it's a minhag. There are bases to give a woman a hetzer, but the basic rule is that you're supposed to cover your hair. I mean, if it's a situation where you can't for whatever reason, then you have to ask a shayla. But the general idea, though, people make a mistake. They think that that looseness, you see, and demonstrativeness and so forth makes you more attractive. And Chazal say that no, they understood the psychology, that there is no one who is more attractive than the tznua. A modest person, a tznua, is more attractive. There's something that's very attractive in terms of tznua. Because you see, that even a person like Shem, who's not an advanced intellectual, but he can perceive that this is a person of quality. Yeah, I'm sorry. Yeah. But she went out to meet Yaakov, so she had that quality of aggressiveness. Okay. No. She's referring to when Leah went out to with the Dudaim, to say, "Stay with me." It was like a little bit lacking in modesty. Still, in all, it was lacking in modesty. A woman's not supposed to be that bold and sexually suggestive. Come, Leah, you know, come to my tent tonight. You see, of course, she was doing it for. The quality. All right, so now let's continue, though. Now, let's continue. What happened was a complete change. When he got to know her, and when he got to see her qualities, he fell in love with her. This is genuine love. And at that point, he no longer forced himself upon her sexually. Because now, you see, that's clear from this. No, he wouldn't have asked for him. I'll leave her, but I'll tell you why it is. Because his desire changed. When he first saw her, it was a sexual thing. He didn't know her yet. So he merely wanted to gratify his sexual desire. Once he got to know her, and he fell in love, so what does he want now? It's not the sex per se, he wants her love. That's what he wants. You see, when a person is in love, of course there's a desire to have sexual relations with the love object, but that's an attempt not to force itself upon, because then you want the sex as an expression of their love. So now the thing that he wanted the most was the love. The whole situation changes. That's why, by Adabra Aliba, now he becomes a complete gentleman. He wasn't willing to go so far as to just return her, but he was hoping to win her over, and that's when he went to the family. But from that point on, he didn't humiliate her anymore, because that wasn't his purpose, just to have sex with her. His purpose was to have her love. Yes, so you have to speculate, but in the way she conducted herself and her dignity and so forth, it's true Chazal criticized that she's a little bit forward, but that's not the whole picture. she was a high-level person. And when he got to see her qualities, this was something unusual for him. I'm sure the other daughters of, you know, Canaan did not behave this way. He saw a certain inner dignity, a certain strength, a certain modesty, a certain dignity. And, of course, he might have felt guilty. This probably brought on a feeling of guilt, too. I'm sure he felt guilty, but it wasn't just guilt, because guilt doesn't last that long. This was something new. He'd never encountered a Dina. He didn't have those kind of girls around. Interesting, because it's a separate question. We never really went into it, why it was that Abraham insisted that Eliezer choose a girl, not from Canaan, but to go back to the Ur Kasdim, where he had come from. What the difference was, because they weren't tzaddikim. Even from his own family, he had love on you. They weren't all tzaddikim. All right, but so therefore, exactly. So you see that the daughters of Canaan were very base, exactly. More sensual, sexual, openly so, like in our society today. And that type of inappropriate, exactly what you're right. That's the way the girls go around. I mean, even on the college campuses, even. Let's see, I know why I said even. But I mean, the truth of the matter is, from what I hear from my students, it's a whole other question whether you can get a college in the summer. So they tell the girls, it's not, they don't dress much differently than you would on the beach. And that's just like you can't go to the beach. So the question is, can you go to college? That's a good, certain streets you really might not be able to. It's true. In certain areas, you're right. No, you can't, a person who goes to the streets, if it's just incidental, maybe somebody else, but in a place where girls congregate and they're dressed that way, you can't go. But the truth of the matter is, though, that she was completely different, and she was unique, and that's why he responded that way. Now, what was the? Let's go on. One more thing I would like to finish. I'll take questions afterwards. I want to get through the negotiations. Remember, we had. Now, what do they do? So Yaakov kept quiet till the brothers came home. We wanted to find out what exactly was the mirma. Where was the mirma over here in the plan? They spoke with tremendous chachma. Now, what was the purpose of Shem and Hamor? Remember, I asked you before that there's a repetition that first Hamor makes the request for Dina, and then after everything is done, then Shem pipes up and makes one double request. Now, it seems to me like this, that Hamor went to his father Shem to acquire her legitimately, for covet. Now he wants to do everything with covet, with honor. Hamor agreed to take it up, but Hamor had his own agenda as well. It wasn't, in other words, the strategy that he utilized was not just to get Dina for his son, but what else did he want? He wanted to enrich himself. He saw an opportunity to enrich himself. Because obviously he had observed these people. He saw that they were very, very successful, they were wealthy, they were industrious, and it would be an expansion of his own power and his own position and his wealth and everything if he could integrate these people. So he wanted to use the situation of this marriage as an opportunity to create a bridge and to bring these people in. Now, he was very, very generous, it would seem, in the negotiation. When he negotiated with them, he just about gave into everything. But his deeper intentions, he wasn't such a tzaddik. When he went back to his own townspeople, and you see what is real, he did not have intentions of going along with the plan the way it was stated. He just told that to Yaakov. Now, what was his objective? His objective is that we want to join together. He says, when he comes to them, he says, our mission, we have two objectives over here. One is the specific, right? To marry, to get your daughter, Dina, to marry my son, right? And then he says, but there's more than that. Let's make a permanent relationship. We want you to become a permanent part of the land. Right now you're nomads. You move from place to place. You just happen to settle over here. We want to make a whole new arrangement with you, to make you a permanent part of the land. You'll make this your home. And therefore, we will have a relationship with each other. We'll do business together. You'll benefit from us. We'll benefit from you. There'll be marriage. You'll marry. It'll be good for you. You'll marry from our daughters. We will marry your daughters. But in making the proposal, everything is making it seem like everything is for your benefit. You will have the benefit. You won't be strangers. You won't be nomads. You'll be permanent. In terms of marriage, you'll have the upper hand. You'll choose the ones whom you want. You will only give to us, and we'll take only the ones you want to give to us. Right? And you'll dwell with us. You'll have our protection. The land will be before you. Dwell with Charuah. Develop your business. You have tremendous business potential, and given the opportunities and the freedom, you could increase tremendously. So that's the proposal. So his proposal is basically for an overall change in relations. That's the proposal that he wanted to make to them. Then, you see, the thing is like this. Now Shechem had to talk up. Shechem had to talk up. Because the father was proposing a general change in the situation. Okay? Okay, they can agree to the general change, but that doesn't mean that we agree to this particular marriage, because as he has stated, you will be the ones to decide which daughters you will give to us. You see? So he comes with the proposal. I'm proposing a whole new relationship between us. Of course, I would like for my son, as a father, I'd like for my son to marry your daughter. But that's in the context of a whole new relationship, in which you'll have the upper hand. Now, Shechem comes along to bolster his personal. Because assuming that they're going to agree to the general plan of exchanging, you know, of intermarrying, he's got to solidify what's the proposal for this particular one. That's when Shechem makes his personal appeal. And Shechem, of course, he had problems facing him. Why should we accept him? He's a lowlife. He's a rapist. So he comes in to show that he has, and the whole essence of his thing is to show that he has total respect for Dina. And he doesn't mention, whether it was wise or not, I don't know, leave that to your imagination. He doesn't mention a word about what he did. He doesn't apologize. Whether that was the wise thing to do or not, I don't know. It doesn't really matter, because he's dealing with people that are smarter than he is, and they have their own problems. Would have made, believe me, it would not have made much difference. But that's why he says, because everything that he is, in his context, he wasn't aware of the moral dimension of the Toeva, of the abomination. He could only look at it as disrespected. You see, if this were to take place, like amongst the mafia, they have their own code. And, you know, you can do anything you want. You know, you have to be loyal to your own wife, this and that, but you can't cheat with somebody else's wife. See, that's, now, well, not because there's anything that's a question of morality, but it's a disrespect. You're disrespecting the guy. So, right, whenever they talk, I didn't mean no disrespect. That's a big word. You can't disrespect another person. He put it in that framework. That he shows he has nothing but the greatest respect for her. And how does a guy express, what is the expression of respect? How to know, just whatever you want. I'll name it. You name the price. So he's willing to pay anything. That's his proposal. Alright? Now, let's just take one more thing. What was the chachma? What was the plan? What was their plan over here? Exactly. But I think that they realized that these people kept to themselves. I would say that Chamor and Shem were smart enough to realize that these people didn't accept other people as wives. They didn't intermarry. They had their own. So therefore, why would they make an exception to Dina? Why should they? I mean, their answer will be, they anticipated. And you see that Dina had told Shem, as we surmised, I told him that I can't agree to this. This is something different. We don't marry out of the family, so to speak. So you got to get my father's permission. So Chamor was smart enough to realize that they're not just going to make an exception for Dina. So therefore, you've got to change your whole proposal. Yes. The whole essence of their plan and the trickery was to make everything to go along with them. You see, to make everything conditional upon acceptance of Mila. That was their plan. To get them to accept the condition of Mila, that whatever you want to do, in order to do it, it's going to require Mila. Now why did they want to do that? Now, to do so, they have to do it in an intelligent way. You can't just, you see, when you're negotiating, you've got to negotiate in a very intelligent way. And when you have a certain demand, right, and you want to have a chance to get it across, you can't just say, that's my demand. I mean, you have to really present it in a way that it makes sense to the other party, so that the other party will accept it. And also, one thing, bear in mind that they can't just throw it out in a crazy kind of a way. Because even if Hamor accepts it, Hamor has to go back to all the people in the town and get them to accept it. So they've got to give, they've got to present it to Hamor in a way that makes some kind of sense, so that when Hamor goes back, he can get the people. Now the reason that they're not suspicious, of course, and they're not suspicious, yeah. Now the reason why they wanted to make everything contingent upon the acceptance of Mila was for two possible reasons. Either it'll turn out that they won't accept it. It's just, they knew psychologically that this is a very painful thing. But they're asking for a lot over here. For in order, this is basically unheard of. Just to enable us to do business, in order to do some business together and stay in the land, as far as marriage is concerned, so then, all right, there I can understand. We will not allow our daughter to marry someone who is uncircumcised. So that make that particular individual. Some make it just, they could have said simply, Shifishchan. Why did they say that? And their retort could have been, see, Shem could have come back and said, look, I can't get the entire people, but I'm willing to take new circumcision. But that wasn't, you see, so the whole chachma of the plan was to get them to accept that as a condition, that is, either or, if you accept that, we'll go ahead. Now, what if they do decide to go ahead? That's, so let's say they agree. So now you have to give up Dina. Well, that we're not sure. Shimon and Levi had their plan. Shimon and Levi had no intention of giving up Dina. Apparently their plan was like this. They said, and if not, we'll take our daughter and we'll leave. So they stuck with the position said, well, but they had to act that way.
So you have to
they had to negotiate that way. Their plan was either hoping like this, that they would, having negotiated in good faith and gone through this, perhaps, if they come back and said that we will not accept this, we can't get them to accept circumcision, so then, that's it. Deal's open. Maybe they would have given Dina back. That's one possibility. They might have. There might have been some honor there. On the other hand, if they accept the circumcision, clearly, I don't know what Yaakov had in mind, but clearly Shimon and Levi held, good, then let them all circumcise. Then they'll be completely helpless, in a state of pain, powerless, and we will have our way. Now what exactly they were going to do if they were to circumcise, what Yaakov had in mind, what the other sons had in mind, and what Shimon and Levi, what they had in mind, you know. Shimon and Levi would, I would imagine, were hoping that they would agree and accept it. I just want to do one more point though. How did they manage to get them to accept it? Saying it's true. That the way they presented was in the form of non-negotiable. There are certain things that are non-negotiable. That today, everybody has non-negotiable demand. Yes. But the only problem with that is, it's a little bit strange. It's a little bit strange just to have a business relationship, to stay in the place and have a business relationship. Okay, when it comes to marriages, first of all, when you take one of our daughters, the deal was like this, you can have the pick of our daughters. So no circumcision involved there. And when you choose to give your daughter, so that's manly, well, that's fine, circumcision. But what do we, everybody have to, before we get started, how did they get them to accept that?
They set up on exactly what Hamor was offering. You see,
Hamor did not present the idea of one nation. Hamor had the idea of two separate people. Right? It's a dwelling, it's our land. We respect your independence. But we want you to have permanence. You have permanent rights. You could be a minority. It just like the idea of autonomy. We don't want to be one nation with the Arabs. But if they accept Shamir's plan, we'll give you a certain amount of autonomy. But it's not one people. We're not offering one people. That's basically what Hamor was saying. We want you to feel at home here. You'll have independence. You'll do business with us. In terms of marriage, of course, people should have the right to marry anybody they want. But you'll have the upper hand. Now, what they did was they listened to their proposal, and they said, fine. They said, it's a fantastic proposal. We like the idea. We're very optimistic. So you see, they hid all of their anger. They didn't show any anger whatsoever. They didn't even bring up the incident that had happened, anything about rape. They didn't use the rape word or anything like that. The R word. But they only added one thing, Vayila and Echad. What were they saying over there? They were saying, you have to understand our position. We can't, we're nomads, we move from place to place, and there's a reason why we do so. Because people perceive us as being different. We have different customs, we have different habits, and one of the main differences that we have is the fact of circumcision. And therefore, there's only one way in which we can feel confident that we're not going to. And you see, so like, well, they didn't bring an argument from Jewish history, but I'm trying to show you that. In Jewish history, the Jews were invited very often. Spain, when they needed them for business, England, they invited them in, they gave them everything they wanted. Then, after they didn't need them anymore, they kicked them right out. There were expulsions, there were persecutions. Look what happened in Germany. So, if you're really sincere and you want to have this, it's very, very nice. So let's become one people. Then there won't be any distinctions amongst us anymore. Then we can feel confident. Now, if that's the case, there's only one way. This is our nationalistic identity. We can't even question. And that's where Laurie's point comes in. Because the only way that we can be acceptable is if you all become just like us. Circumcision. It's a nationalistic kind of a thing with us. It's something that can't be questioned. We can't give up circumcision. And circumcision is a barrier. The fact of the matter is that's one of the main things that separates the Jews from other people. You see, even by Yosef. It says when they came to Pharaoh and complained, and he said, whatever Yosef tells you to do, do. And remember, why were they complaining? Because he said that they should circumcise themselves. So Yosef recognized that one of the main reasons for the animosity, for the bad feelings that people have about Jews has to do with the fact that the Jews are circumcised. Yeah, so Rashi. And that's why they complained to Pharaoh. Pharaoh said, so what did you save your food? You should have saved your food. They said, yes, he saved it, but it got spoiled. So he said, huh, you see, he put it a different form. He said, you see that Yosef decreed against the food, that Yosef caused the food to spoil. And if you don't listen, he'll kill us all. Whatever. The point of it is that the brilliance was, as Ronit pointed out, that he had one thing, that's the only way we can accept your terms. So it's beautiful. We're accepting everything that you want, but it's got to be in the framework of what, being one nation. That's reasonable. Now, that is, see, if you go back, yes, an extension. But without that, there's no basis for circumcision. If you don't add that, then what's the circumcision? Just have a business relationship. Of course, yes. That's the brilliance of it. That shows them that we like your idea. It's very good, but the only way that it can work for us is if it's on echad. If it's on echad, then you've got to accept circumcision. Are you going to accept circumcision? So you put the ball in there. Now, when Chamorro goes back, how is Chamorro going to convince the townspeople? Do you see that he goes back to them? And he was very smart. First, he says, "Hanoshim Eila Shleiman." I've spoken to these people. They're fantastic people. They're men of peace. They don't have any animosity against us. Because they knew, the people of the town knew about the incident with Dina, and still they don't have any hatred against us. They're not out to harm us in any way. Then he tells them, let's be Yeshivarit, and now of course there's a certain resistance, newcomers. You know, there's always that negative feeling. You have it now with against immigrants that come into America, you have it even in Europe with immigrants. There's always that negative feeling, they're going to take away our jobs. So that's the, no, it's going to be economically useful for us. We don't have that many people. We need more people. So they'll increase, they're fantastic people in terms of business. They'll increase the business opportunities. Then he says the marriage factor, we can marry from their daughters, and we can have the great men to marry your daughters. Or if you can marry top guys, they have top prospects over here, right? So everything is positive. But now he has to bring up this, to get them to accept circumcision. Ach for those. Only with this. Now listen to what he says. In Chavdei, Lashevet Itanu, to agree to live with us, Lios Yanachat. They'll only agree to live with us if we become one nation. And that is, the Himo, specifically. Because that's their mark of a people, that's their sign of a nation, which you know, and that's non-negotiable. There's no way I can't even discuss this. It is non-negotiable, nothing to talk about. Because that's what the brother says. If not, we're going to take our daughters and we're going to leave. Then you see, having said that, he has to attach it to us, some immediate, there's going to be, he just wants to mind the pain, exactly, the pain. See, the other things he said, you're right, is abstract. You know, okay, it's better business, we have a prospectus, the GNP, that's abstract. We don't know, we're not going to have anything immediately. Then he says, immediately, McNahum, they have so much cattle, they have so much possessions, immediately we'll partake, we'll benefit from it. It doesn't mean, he's not telling them we're going to steal it from them, but it means to say, we're going to gain immediately. Everything, because all the wealth that they have now becomes part of their national treasure. National treasure, it's all ours, the parts, the taxes, whatever the case may be. Ach, now he refers to Neil again. How does he refer to it? Ach, ne osalahem. But we have to be acceptable. It's a euphemism. He doesn't want to use the word circumcision. Now he's got to be using, it's just a question of becoming acceptable to them, you see? And the eighth we tunnel, and they'll grow with us, you see? Oh, so now they heard it. It was a television proposal. We came back, we're talking about expanding, we're small people, we're going to expand economically, we're going to have a big merger, it's going to, McNahum, they're fantastic people, everything on every front, our lives will improve, they were willing to accept it. That was the brilliance, that was the chachma. The chachma was to be able to, of course, to hide all the negative emotions, not even to bring up what he had done, but to take their proposal and to put a little twist on it, which accepted everything, but put it in a twist in which the demand, the non-negotiable demand from Mila, would be reasonable, would be something that they couldn't be argued against. And having done so, yeah, of course, having done so, they managed to trick the entire city of Shechem, and we explained how they did it, by getting them to agree to the basic proposal of joining together as one nation, provided they would accept one condition. That was the condition of Mila, of circumcision. And having done so, on the third day, when they were in a state of helplessness, a state of pain, so Shimon and Levi went in and utterly destroyed them, wiped them all out. And it seems then, well, a lot of questions emerged from this. Many questions emerged. For example, afterwards, Yaakov rebuked them very severely. And later on in Vayechi, he curses them. He doesn't curse them, he curses their anger. And says that they'll be divided. He won't let them stay together in Eretz Yisrael, because when these two get together, they can be dangerous. They have this element of anger and aggressiveness. So he criticizes them. But that, we said, is difficult, because it seems from the story itself that he was together with them when they negotiated with Shechem and Hamor. So, what was Yaakov's idea? Wasn't Yaakov aware of the plan? Also, what is difficult, what has to be explained, is what gave them the right. And we're talking about great people. These are our moral role models, so to speak, these 12 leaders of the Shvatim. These are great people. How could they wipe out an entire city? It seems as though they did a terrible thing. They wiped out and despoiled the entire city. Now, it's one thing to fight in order to rescue Dina. That we can understand. Because she was, well, he had raped her, and now he was holding her against her will, was kidnapping. And that's the kind of thing you're permitted, you're obligated to say. That's Hatzolah. That's Hatzolah. That's saving a life. You know, there's two cases where you're permitted to kill the perpetrator of a crime before he commits the crime. In every other case where you're chayav misa, where you're liable to the death penalty, you're not allowed to kill the person prior to the commission of the crime. For example, if a person is about to be machal shabbos, you're not allowed to stop him by killing him. Afterwards, however, you take him to Besdin, when we have Sanhedrin. When we have Sanhedrin, you take him to Sanhedrin, and you testify against him, and they proceed, and they find him guilty, and they execute him. But you can't kill him prior to the deed. There's only two cases where you can kill a perpetrator in order to prevent the deed from occurring. Does anybody know what I'm referring to? Road Dave? Or not just you. Anybody else? Anybody else? If one person is chasing after another person to kill him, then you're obligated to kill him. You're obligated to save the life of the victim by killing the, if necessary. But suppose you don't have to kill him. Suppose you can shoot him in the arm or shoot him in the leg, and instead you kill him. You're not allowed to do that. You know, then you yourself are a murderer. If you remember those, you did Tanakh. That was the argument between who? That was the argument between Avner and Yoav. Yoav killed Avner. He claimed that he did it because he was Chayav Misa. Avner had killed his brother. His brother Amasha. Amasha. Excuse me. But that was that's a separate case. I won't go into it right now. What's the other case of Rode? Yes. He's also defined as a Rode if a man is chasing after a girl to rape her. So that would define him as a Rode. And you're permitted to execute, if necessary. But that's the only two cases. So we understand that they were permitted to kill in order to save Dina, but they went way above and beyond that. Hey, what that would only be with regard to Shram. I'm sorry? Okay, that's Asoyo. Right. And there wasn't. What gave them the right to wipe out the entire city? And they despoiled, they took all the spoils. It seems like they just went on a wild rampage. And of course, you know, we can't understand it that way. Look at the Ramban. Does anybody have the Ramban? The Ramban discusses this question. That's on Perek Lama Dalad, Pasuk Gimel. So on the Pasuk Bayanu Bnei Yaakov Eshchem, the Eschamor of is B'mirma, which says that the sons of Yaakov responded to Shechem, and Hamor, his father, was cunning. There's a very lengthy Ramban here. He says that Hamor and Shechem spoke to her father and her brothers, but the old one, that is Jacob, did not answer them, didn't say a word. Somebody asked him this question anyway, because his children spoke in his place with regard to this matter, due to his honor. To preserve his honor, he didn't get involved in these kind of things, these kind of negotiations. But he was there. Because, since the matter was degrading to them, if they wanted to protect him from having even to discuss it. It was very degrading, the whole business. But that was for his honor. They spoke for him. He says, and there's a problem here. Because it appears that the entire thing was done with the consent of Yaakov and with his advice. They answered in front of him. He knew. He knew what the idea was, and he knew that they were speaking for Mirma. He knew that it was a trick. Now if he knew that it was a trick, so why did he get angry? In other words, the Pasuk says for Mirma. The Pasuk says that they put together this plan with Mirma, with cunning. Which I interpret to mean that they had no intention of keeping it. It was something that they were permitted to do to save Dina. Moreover, how can you understand that they could have meant this seriously? Let's say Yaakov did not know about the idea of killing. What was his idea? How could they have been forthright in this matter? Let's assume that as occurred, they accepted the condition of circumcision. So now how could they give Dina to Shem? What does that mean? So what? So we circumcise ourselves. It doesn't mean anything. In order to be worthy to marry her, he'd have to do more than just circumcise. What would he have to do? Well, conversion, or whatever conversion exists at that time. It's not formal conversion like today, because it was before Torah, to accept the Sheva Mitzvot Bnei Noach, to certainly accept the seven Noahide laws. But above and beyond that, because the Jews had more than just the seven, primarily, of course, would be a circumcision, but I agree, in other words, we'll use the term conversion. But to accept all the ideas and principles by which they lived. Otherwise, How could they allow her to marry him? It doesn't make any sense. He'd be like what we would call a guy. I mean, a certain guy wouldn't be applicable in that situation because he didn't have Jews. But look at him in the context that we understand. Yes? No, he asked my question. Moreover, he says, it doesn't make sense that it would be his desire to marry his daughter to a Canaanite who had defiled her. Well, just because he accepted circumcision. I mean, it sounds like today, like a lot of these conversions, you know, that people want to, you know, marry a Jewish guy or a Jewish girl, so they go to a conservative former rabbi, they go to the thing, oh, you have to have a man, have to have circumcision, because I think everybody can have that. And that's the end of the story. But it's worthless, because conversion by itself is meaningless. They don't accept mitzvot. Now, he says this. All of the brothers answered were together in this answer of deceit. But he says Shimon and Levi alone did the action. So he's suggesting the possibility that the plan was hatched by the entire group, and they were all doing it with trickery. But there was a difference in the intention between Shimon and Levi and the rest. Apparently Shimon and Levi had their own agenda, their own plans, and they kept it secret even from the other brothers. They went along with this plan because it fitted in with what they wanted to do. And the father cursed their anger alone. Well, that makes sense. That makes sense. That's a very good proof. The fact of the matter is, if the other brothers participated in the killing, then he should have cursed their anger too. Why did he curse only Shimon and Levi? Now, here's the answer. The deceit was when they told them to circumcise every male, as we've explained last week. Because they thought that the people of the city wouldn't do it. In other words, as we said, the brilliance of the strategy was to come up with something which really put them in the best possible bargaining position. Right? They couldn't just turn them down, they couldn't just say no, that would offend them. And of course they couldn't just say yes. So they had to answer. And they answered in a brilliant way by saying the plan is very, very good, but there's only one drawback. There's only one condition, which is non-negotiable, as he said. It's non-negotiable. There's nothing we can do about this. We just can't marry. It's a chepa. It's degrading to us. We just have to accept it. We cannot intermarry with someone who's not circumcised. Without even explaining why. And therefore, to convince the entire city to accept it, they assume would not be an easy thing to do. And we said it was contingent upon the entire city accepting it. Otherwise, there wouldn't nothing go. So either they would just turn it down; they couldn't accept it. That would then, having negotiated in good faith, there'd be a certain pressure upon them to give back Dina. They have to keep their side. And that was one possibility. If they would come back and say we can't get the entire city, and they still didn't want to give back Dina, I guess they'd have to do something else. But that was one possibility. On the other hand, if they did accept it, now what happens if they do accept it? He says like this: if, however, they would listen to their rulers as they did, and they would all become circumcised, then they would come on the third day when they were in a state of pain, and they would simply rescue. They'd perform a rescue mission. So the plan, the mirma, was that they never had any intention of keeping what they had agreed to. They had no intention of keeping what they had agreed to, and best case would be they wouldn't agree and they'd give Dina back, or even if they were to agree, and when they were weak, they'd come in and they would rescue her. They'd rescue her. Yes? Suppose they would have come back and said the rest of the town won't go along with it, but we just want this particular case. Yeah, I think I answered that last week. Exactly. They said that they'll only consider this in the context of one people. We're not going to marry outside our people. So if you want, that's right, you have to become part of our people. And then we'll consider, and of course, the way it was set up, they had the upper hand. They had the upper hand to decide who they would, which was also very good for them. Because Shem had said, you will give your daughters to us, implying, oh, so therefore that gave them an option to say, we're not going to give Dina. Okay. Now, this was the strategy of all the brothers, and Yaakov gave this plan his blessing. However, Shimon and Levi wanted revenge. wants to avenge them. So they killed all the men of the city. This is the explanation of the Ramban. So this fits in very nicely. If you see the flow of the story, it says what happens on that day. If you take a look, it was on the third day when they were in pain. And then it says that the two sons of Yaakov, Shimon and Levi, the brothers of Dinah, they were closest to Dinah, they each took their sword, and they came silently upon the city, and they wiped out every male. And they killed Hamor and Shechem by the sword. And they took Dinah from the house of Shechem, and they left. Now in 27, it says, B'nei Yaakov, bo ala chalolim, the sons of Yaakov. Now, who are these sons of Yaakov? Is this the self-same Shimon and Levi? Or is this the other sons as well? Well, you could take it either way. But apparently, according to Ramban, the only ones that were involved were Shimon and Levi. And then this also fits in well with Yaakov's reaction. Yaakov said to Shimon and Levi, "You have defiled me to cause me to be hated amongst the people." In other words, you put me in a situation of great danger. So, according to the Ramban, it all revolves around Shimon and Levi. Okay? Right? That's an adequate explanation. But, and he says it makes sense to say that Yaakov was angry with them. He cursed their anger for killing the people of the city who had not sinned against him. And it was fitting, what was proper was to kill Shechem alone. In other words, he's saying that Yaakov would not have been upset had he only killed Shechem. He was upset because they killed the entire people of the city who were innocent. That's Lori's question. And this is the meaning of the verse which says that the sons of Yaakov answered. The sons of Yaakov answered Shechem and Hamor's father with trickery, and they spoke concerning the fact that they had defiled their sister Dinah, because they all agreed on the matter to speak to him with deceit because of the abomination that he had done to them. Okay, that's the end of that phase. Now, many ask the question, how can the sons of Yaakov, Tzaddikim, who were righteous, how could they do this action? To spill innocent blood. Now, he says that Harav, Heshe, who's the Rav? The Rambam answers this question. So let's turn to the Rambam. We'll go directly to the source. The Rambam answers this question in Hilchos Malachim, Perek Tes, Halacha Yudalit. Now, in this, if you're interested, by the way, in this Perek he takes up the Noahide laws, the seven Noahide laws, and the ramifications. And he says like this in 14. The Ketad Mitzuvin Hein Al Adin. Is there reference to the seven Noahide laws? What they are, doesn't have, if there's only seven. He says, this is in the first halacha. He says, other Marisha was commanded on six. The seven Noahide laws came in two phases. Six were given to Adam. Idolatry, the cursing of God, spilling blood, murder, forbidden sex arayos, the forbidden sexual relations, such as adultery and so forth, stealing, gezel, and dinim. Dinim means what? Yeah, to have a court system, enforcement. And with Noah, he added one. Does anybody know? Eva Machai. To eat a limb from an animal before it's been killed, from a live animal. Now, this wasn't given to Adam for obvious reasons, because Adam was not permitted to eat meat. Noah was permitted to eat meat after the flood, after the mouth. Okay? Now, he says, then he goes on to explain each one, the particular laws pertaining to each one. And in 14 he says, how are they commanded concerning laws, the court system? They are obligated to establish judges and shoved him and, you know, court people, governors, whatever, rulers, in every city to judge them concerning these six. So in other words, you have six mitzvot, then the seventh one is really pertaining to the judgment and the enforcement, and to warn the people. And he says, a ben Noach who violates one of these seven mitzvot is killed with the sword. So he has one punishment for any violation, which is death by the sword. And now he goes into an interesting aside. He says, because of this, all of the people of Shechem, all of the members of the city of Shechem, were chayev misa. Kol Ba'alei Shechem Harega were killed. Why? Because Shechem stole. So he defines the essence of the sin as being gezel. Kidnapping. He stole. That's stealing. He stole a person. You steal a person's property, you're chayev, certainly if you steal the person himself. And, okay, what about the rest of them? They saw, and they knew, and they didn't judge him. So that means to say that they were guilty of not enforcing the seven Ochai laws. So now they're chayev misa. And then he says the Ben Noach is killed with one witness. You don't need two witnesses. And with one judge, you don't need a Sanhedrin. Nor do you need hasra. You don't need warning. And even through relatives. But then he mentions not by the testimony of a woman. Okay. And a woman can't be a judge for that. Okay, that's a separate point. But Ramban takes it up. So what is he saying? What's the Ramban's interpretation? According to the Ram's interpretation, what they did was fully justified. They had every right to do it. And not only was Shechem the perpetrator, not only was Shechem Chayav Misa, and not only was his father Chayav Misa, but every member of the city was Chayav Misa because they were derelict in one of the seven Ochai laws. That is, to enforce the other law. Now here's a case where they had to enforce the law. He was guilty of stealing. And they all knew about it, and they let him get away with it. They failed to judge, and therefore they were not keeping the seven Ochai laws, so they had to be destroyed. So, according to the Rambam, and well, since the Ramban mentioned this point, they did a good thing. They did the right thing. And, I don't know, the question would be, according to the Rambam, they did a wonderful deed. Why was Yaakov angry with them? Right. Why would Yaakov be angry with them? They deserved a yashikach. They deserved a yashikach. Instead they got a patch. They got a patch. They got a klala. My goodness. Bad news.
What is the Rambam? How is the Rambam
answer? Jackie is saying, according to the Rambam,